I'm currently standing on the beach here with Tug, my dog, and producer Ollie on our way to Pip Stewart. Pip is a journalist and presenter. After graduating, Pip worked in Asia for 5 years as an anchor and reporter in Hong Kong and Malaysia. Following that, she and her partner Charlie cycled back to London from Malaysia, covering 10,000 miles and 26 countries in a year. In 2016, her adventures took her on a 3,000-mile cycle, boat and plane journey, exploring Brazil and Peru with Reza Pakravan, who we're actually also talking to. In 2018, she teamed up with Laura Bingham and Ness Knight to attempt to be the first people to ever paddle the entire Essequibo River in Guyana. Pip's always had fascinating ideas about what it means to connect with other people and the outdoors. It's really kind of her to let us drop in as she's just had her first baby, so I'm really interested to see if this has changed her perspective on adventure at all. Let's go.
I'm Megan Hines, survival consultant on shows such as Man vs. Wild and Running Wild with Bear Grylls. This is The Power of Adventure, a podcast designed to inspire listeners and encourage them to put an adventurous mindset at the heart of their lives.
Hello.
Hey, hi, Bear.
How are you? Nice to meet you.
So good to meet you.
You well?
Yeah, really good.
Yeah. Okay.
Down to the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
So nice.
Brought the weather with you as well.
I know. So I'm sat here with Pip next to the beach, and my goodness, Pip has just had a little baby, which is incredible. So thank you so much for taking time out of motherhood to talk to us. I mean, I've been listening to your podcast and following you on social media, and you have developed this quite unique brand of adventure and journalism, which all mixes together so well and so beautifully. Has the adventure been something that you've always done?
Sweet. Well, first, thanks for having me, Megan. And hallelujah, I managed to wash before you came, which is an achievement at the moment, having a three-week-old baby. But I call myself sort of an accidental adventurer because I never really meant to get into this adventure world. I moved to Hong Kong to study journalism.
Right.
And that was, for me, a real eye-opener because I'm like, actually, the stories and the people that I'm encountering are so fascinating. And then we moved from Hong Kong to Malaysia. And then we thought, okay, maybe it's time to go back home. And Charlie, my partner, suggested that we cycle back. And at the time, I was like, oh my gosh, no, I can't do this. You know, I cycled around uni, but not far. I'm not an athlete, you know.
Yeah. And this is cycling from
Malaysia
back to the UK.
Yeah, so it's
how
about,
far is that?
It's about 10,000 miles or 15,000 kilometres.
And you've never really done much cycling before?
No, no. But in my brain, right, you know when you just say yes to something and you commit to it? I was like, it'll be fine. And then I started telling people. I was like, oh, I'm going to cycle from Malaysia to London. Hadn't really thought it through, to be honest.
Had you looked at the map?
Well, I'd looked at a map and I kind of, on our website that I put together, I put up and then left in terms of how to get back for route. So that was as basic as it got, really. But yeah, we sort of set off having not really trained much. You know, the first time I rode a fully loaded bike was the day we set off, which was an error. And if anyone's listening, don't do that. Do some practice. Yeah, 3 weeks in, had an absolute meltdown. Said to Charlie, you picked the wrong girl. I tried to break up with him. It was awful. Sat on the side of the road crying. And he said something to me that I'll never forget, which is, these are not physical journeys, they're mental ones. And as soon as I had that in my brain, I was like, okay, do you know what? I'm not the fittest. I'm not an athlete, but by God, I'm going to get there one way or another. And we just went really slowly. And at starts of hills, I'd, you know, get off my bike and push up. And then gradually I'd cycle halfway up a hill. And then finally I was cycling up mountains. But it was a very slow process. And anyone who's been on expeditions with me will go, she is slow. so, you know, I'm not going to break any speed records, but I love it. And that's the thing. You kind of end up in places that you just wouldn't normally end up. And back to your point about storytelling, that's where I found my most interesting stories, in the places that you're not necessarily looking for stories.
Yeah, I suppose it's like, because we live such fast lives now, don't we? And actually, with what you're doing and like properly slowing down there and, you know, getting on your bike and fully immersing yourself in that environment, it's like, did the stories then come off the back of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, for example, you know, my latest expedition, which was kayaking in Guyana, one of the stories that I've sort of uncovered as a result of that was getting this flesh-eating parasite from a sandfly bite, basically. I discovered this thing is called leishmaniasis. It's the second biggest parasitic killer after malaria. And I had no idea before I set off. I mean, obviously we'd done like a risk assessment and you look at all the things that could go wrong in expedition. And I'd sort of vaguely written down this thing called leishmaniasis, but I had never kind of dove into what it actually was or who was affected. And you suddenly uncover this massive global story. It's a huge problem globally. You know, 98 countries have leishmaniasis.
And what is leishmaniasis?
So essentially it's a flesh-eating parasite. I came home with a small bite on my neck. And obviously, you know, in jungle environments, you're just covered in bites,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So it's just miserable.
Yeah, you're just itchy and uncomfortable and you just think, whatever, that's just jungle.
Yeah.
But this one didn't go away and it just got bigger and bigger and like more pussy. It was smelly at one point, but it didn't hurt or itch, which was really weird.
Yeah.
So I went to London's Hospital for Tropical Diseases when I came back and they did a little biopsy and they said, yeah, we think you've got this thing called leishmaniasis. And if you don't treat it, it might eat off your nose and your soft palate.
Wow.
I'm like, whoa, that is intense. Luckily, being in London, I say luckily, I was pumped full of a very toxic heavy metal. It's an old form of chemo that dates from the 1940s. Crazy. So I sort of laid up on a bed for, you know, 21 days attached to an IV.
Yeah.
But yes, fingers crossed it's fixed it. But I messaged my friends back in Guyana and said, guys, how do you treat this back in the jungle? And my friend Faye said, well, I put boiling cow fat onto my lesions.
What?
And you think about the kids that we met on this journey and think about the villages that we went through and the fact that people are like literally burning themselves. And these treatments may or may not be effective, but there's very little research and very little funding because unfortunately the majority of people who get it are poor.
Yeah.
So, that to me was like one of those huge stories that you sort of uncover accidentally through, you know, just being on an adventure.
Where does it come from? What is it that causes the leishmaniasis?
So it's from the bite of a sandfly. And for anyone thinking, oh, I'm not going anywhere near sandflies, Ibiza, you know, it's in
what?
The Med. And
really?
Especially with climate change and things like that. The more our world is heating up,
wow,
we're
okay.
seeing the movement of insect populations.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a problem that will affect the developing world and already is. Or the developed world, should I say. And so it's a problem that we can no longer afford to ignore. And morally, I think it's a problem we can no longer afford to ignore either.
Yeah, and I mean, it's actually really scary as well. Because although, I mean, you're saying, you're very fortunate to have the NHS and access to that healthcare. I mean, the technique that they're using to cure it is still so outdated and they're pumping you full of these horrible toxins.
Well, this is it. I came back from the jungle and, you know, as I said, I'm not an athlete, but I had abs, Megan. I was like, hallelujah. The first time. So I was quite chuffed. And then obviously finding out I had leishmaniasis and I've never felt like I'd aged so much in my life. Like the treatment was so brutal. I was just ached. I was sore. Could barely get out of bed without help by the end of those 3 weeks. And you just think, wow, how did I go from being the fittest I'd ever been to kind of shuffling around like a 90-year-old? And I am still freaking lucky, you know? And
yeah,
when you kind of think about things like that, it just massively puts life into perspective, really.
Yeah. And have you had any long-term effects from that?
No, so fingers crossed it's cured. I've got a scar on my neck.
Can I see?
Yeah, I call it my little love bite.
Oh, wow. Yes. Oh, yeah, I can see that. Crikey, it was actually big, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it could have been bigger. So that's the thing. I'm like, well, you know, it is what it is. But I actually, in a funny way, quite like it. I don't know, little war wounds, right, in the sense they tell a story.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like the old Sig bottles, like, you know, when they got squashed and stuff, they've all got their story. It's like our bodies, isn't it? It's
yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
Every scar and everything.
Yeah, it was all quirks, right? Yeah. It's like, it tells your life story.
Yeah, no, exactly. And what an amazing story that is. And, you know, and what an incredible cause to be championing as well. Earlier you said that obviously you carried out a risk assessment. Now that's obvious for me, like, because I work, you know, I work professionally in this industry, but it scares me and worries me that so many people going out on adventures don't do this. So it's not even, you know, about writing down a risk assessment, it's just thinking through all the things that can go wrong. Is that something that you do for every trip you plan?
Absolutely, because I think I'm an inherent worrier. So it's like, right, what could go wrong? So it's plan for the best, plan for the worst and expect the best, right?
Yeah.
And hats off to Laura, because Laura Bingham is a friend of mine who organised the trip, and she, it was sort of her little brainchild, and she put in a shed ton of effort. I think she asked me along more as a journalist, so she did a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the organising. But yeah, I think any trip like this, you need to put in prep. And especially with something like a jungle environment, it's about knowing your limits. And, you know, as I say, Megan, I'm not a survivalist. So I knew that I couldn't go out to the jungle and know how to survive on my own. So we recruited the YY community. We had a team from the YY who were invaluable. And to be honest, this expedition wouldn't have happened without them. They were the key to this trip. But they're the masters of survival in that environment. And also, you know, having a team around us who knew what they were doing just made this adventure so much more enjoyable, because you're learning from people who fully understand their environment. You've got people to banter with, you've got, and also it was just funny, you know, they're looking at me chopping down wood going, what are you doing? This is not how you collect dead wood. And so you're learning and improving your own skills. So I think, you know, if you're not a survivalist, be realistic about that. And I'm so with you. We're seeing, I think, with Instagram, so many people going off and doing adventures and trying to look all gnarly. Whereas actually, I think the best thing you can do is admit your weaknesses, admit that you're a newbie, and ask for help, because actually that's so much more rewarding. Like the kayak journey, anyone who is into kayaking would probably look at our expedition and go, well, the water's not very high, it's not massive rapids, like why would you do that? But actually we were all beginner kayakers, and we trained in Wales, and we were in the middle of winter, like in our dry suits, you know, freezing.
Yeah, that's extreme, that's horrible.
Yeah, but again, like you have to start somewhere. And yes, I think our expedition was incredible in the sense of, you know, it was just untouched, pristine wilderness, and we got the chance to spend time in it. But it was also a challenge for us personally, and we didn't bite off more than we could chew, in the sense of we weren't doing massive white water or anything like that. So I'd say to anyone listening, you know your limits and skill yourself up, because it's really, it makes you feel so much more confident when you suddenly learn those skills.
And how do you find your limits? You know, for somebody who's never done anything like this before, has seen those amazing pictures on social media, and wants to jump straight in.
Just try something. Whether it's like, you know, my latest thing is I see people horse riding down the beach, and I'm pretty useless on a horse, but I really want to just go and like talk to the riding school and just learn how to ride, because that's kind of my next thing, and do it on the weekends or do it in the evenings. You know, with the kayaking, we were doing weekend trips. So we'd take a weekend, we'd go and find, we joined the British Canoe Symposium, went down for a weekend where you have experts in white water teaching you how to read the water. So it's literally little by little steps, and the more you do, the more confident you feel.
Do you know where the idea behind the Guyana trip came from? Was there a reason why that started, or is it just like, right, we need to go put a pin in the map, off we go?
No, so Laura is married to a guy called Ed Stafford, and Ed did some filming out in Guyana. Ed is also sort of like a survivalist in a sense, and he's walked the lengths of the Amazon, and he came back and said to Laura, oh my gosh, there's this place called the Essequibo. It's unbelievably beautiful. No one has ever kayaked it. It's like Disneyland on speed for animal life. And I think that sort of planted the seed in Laura's mind. And she was like, ooh, that sounds really good. I want to go and do that. And then we'd sort of met each other a few times through the adventure world. We didn't know each other well at all. And she rang me up one day, and I was working at Red Bull as their adventure editor. And I think I just spent a bit too much time in front of the screen, to be honest, Megan. And I was like, oh my gosh, get me out of here. And she said, you know, how do you feel about kayaking down this river? I think I must have heard pina coladas and floating down on a lilo or something. And I said, yeah, absolutely. And then Laura's best friend is a girl called Ness, or a woman called Ness, I should say. And yeah, Ness was on board as well. So I thought, actually, worst case scenario, I go on a trip and we don't get on. Best case scenario, I come back with two new mates. So, and that's sort of what happened.
What was the toughest moments on that trip?
God, for me, I think it was, we hiked to the source of the river. And of all the team, I was definitely physically the weakest. So, you know, struggling with my bag, just sweating like an absolute pig at the back, trying not to let people down.
Because where are you hiking through? Through primary rainforest,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, and as you know, right, a good day you move about 4 kilometres, so it's not exactly fast, is it? And
so you're hacking your way through the jungle?
Yeah, so we're hacking our way through the jungle. It's hot, it's humid. I'm literally collecting half of the forest on my trousers. I don't know how I do it, but I'm super clumsy as well. So I was carrying like bushes and all sorts, just struggling away, swearing that I'm never going to do another physical journey ever again. And then I get my foot stuck between a log and a dead piece of wood. And I must have spent a minute there sort of like wiggling my foot out, trying to free it. And from behind me, Laura goes, "Oh my God, there's a snake." And 2 inches under my bum was something called the Labaria snake, which is one of the ones you don't want to see, right? Known for
Is that Fed Lance? Is that the same?
Yeah. Okay. I think so.
Yes. Yeah.
But known for like fast, swift and deadly attacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jackson, one of our guides, sort of appeared over me with a machete, just macheted it to death. And I was just stunned, to be honest, Megan, because I was like, wow. I'm really in a remote environment. I am weeks away from help. We went to go and see the helicopter rescue team before we set off. And they said, we absolutely can rescue you, but not after 3 p.m. because we can't fly at night. We don't have a winch. And by the way, you need to clear the area the size of a football field for us to land a helicopter.
Oh, bloody hell, yeah. So realistically, rescue is not going to happen.
Yeah, and that snake thing sent me into a bit of a downward spiral because I was like, God, it is my ego. My ego has led me to this point. I have wonderful friends and family back home. I'm doing an expedition on a river that no one has ever heard of. Why? What am I doing? And I think that sort of really made me question a lot of what I was trying to do and why. And I think that was the hardest thing for me when you're battling your own ego. But those sort of days were really dark and I just was like, I can't, there's no way out of here.
Yeah. And
I thought the only thing that sort of consoled me in that moment was, well, I can't change the situation, but I can change my reaction to it. So kind of get a grip, move on, you're safe, you're with people who know what they're doing.
So like an acceptance.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then once that acceptance came, then was the rest of the trip much easier?
It was joyous. And I was so happy that I was there and all those sort of doubts and fears and everything else sort of faded away. But We're as humans, we're light and dark, right? We do have those parts of ourselves that we'd rather people didn't see. We have parts that we really like. And we're like, you know, ideally you want to show more of those parts to people. But every now and again, you do get confronted with the dark bits in you. And I think that's what happened in this trip. I was like, wow, I can be a real egotistical narcissist. And that was really hard to look at. But actually doing so was really beneficial for me, I think.
Yeah. And how can you translate that into everyday life? I mean, how can you encourage, or are there tips that you can think of that for people to have acceptance in everyday life?
Absolutely. I think it's sort of, first of all, fear is always there. And bizarrely on that trip, it was when I started posting more poetry. And it sounds ridiculous, but I've written poetry for years. I absolutely love it. It lights me up. You know, I'm not Shakespeare. I'm pretty average poet, if I'm honest, but like, I love it. And that trip was the first time that I thought, well, you know what? Sod it. Like, why not? Well, like, who? I'm worried about people's judgment. And that's why I'm not posting poetry. But if it lights me up, I'm going to do it. And I think it's the same thing. If you're sat there like harboring this little dream, like, oh, I really want to like cycle to Land's End or something from John O'Groats, like, just go and do it. Because often you'll find that your fear is perception that other people have about you, or you're worried about what people think, or, you know, sort of dig into those things that are holding you back and sort of figure out why am I letting this limit me? Because ultimately I kind of made peace with the fact that, you know, not everyone's going to like my poems, and that's fine. And in the same way with adventure stuff or social media or just anything you want to do in life, you're going to have people who say, what are you doing? You can't do that. You're rubbish, or whatever it is. But actually, if you're kind of pleasing yourself a little bit more, that's really the main thing.
So you've done the Guyana trip and then you went off to Norway, did you?
Yes. So I came back and went on expedition with the Royal Marines, which was an error. I was invited along. They were doing a trip and they were kind of kayaking and they were following in the footsteps of some of the old World War II raids that they did. So hiking up mountains and...
Amazing stories, those, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. Oh, it was like, it was fascinating. But it was also during the World Cup period and they were desperate to watch. I think we got into the semi-finals or something. And we had this bike ride and we had to be at the ferry for a certain time. Otherwise, we weren't going to get to the hotel to watch this freaking football match. And so I sat out and I was like in their slipstream, basically. They're trying to push me along. And at one point, I literally had Marines like shoving me from behind, trying to get me up a hill. And it was amazing because I think what I learned with the Marines is that no woman or man was going to be left behind. Although ultimately, I did have to call time on it because I was looking at my watch thinking, we're not going to make that ferry. But the mentality of the Marines was incredible. And I never once was made to feel slow or weak or like I was holding them back. I very much felt part of a team. And I think that was something I'm like, right, in any sort of sphere of life, I think that's really important. Like, bring people along with you rather than make them feel a bit rubbish.
Yeah. And is that something that they train into them? Or is that something that they learn along the way?
I think so. I think it's a part of like the whole military mentality, isn't it? And that kind of bonding experience. And again, back to the power of being outside, is when you've sweated with someone, when you've like camped with someone, seen each other looking like at your worst, there's just a real bond that happens there. So it's a kind of a learned thing, but I think it's also a nurturing thing. You don't want to let people down when you've gone through all of that together. And it really does bond you. And the reason I was out there with them, I was doing a piece looking at mental health. And they were saying that actually they found trips like this to be so beneficial, because if you're struggling mentally, you're unlikely to sit down like over a cup of tea and just say, dude, I'm really having a tough time, especially in an organization like the Marines. But they all said that actually, you know, when you're together for hours on the water and there's not much else going on and you're not really looking at each other, you're just kind of in that environment, it was so much easier to open up and say, God, I'm really haven't got over what I saw in Afghanistan or this or that. And they said adventure was really powerful for their mental health.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's next? Because obviously you've now got your little baby. Mm. Is it Willow?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the next plan?
Good question. So the next plan is to try and introduce Willow to the world, in a sense. Something that really peed me off, Megan, was when I got pregnant, I had some people say to me, well, that's the end of your adventuring. That's
really?
It. You're going to be a mum. You know, your tolerance for risk is going to change. And, you know, your travelling days are over, basically. And I was like, I really hope not. I can already sense that your tolerance for risk does change. And the idea of Willow going down a freaking kayak in the Amazon, I'm like, no, we'll have to have words about that. But equally, I do want to see the world, because that's the best place to learn, isn't it? Like, get out into the world and meet the people in it. But again, I think looking at the whole climate crisis and things like that as well, my own kind of take on travel's changed a bit as well. I mean, if you go into central London, we've got every single nationality there. And I've spent so long looking outside of the UK for the world, whereas actually a lot of the world is already here. So a lot more UK-based travel. I want to do more family stuff, show that it is possible to travel with kids, or at least maybe it's not, but I want to kind of document that journey about, you know, what are the realities of family travel? And yeah, do more sort of poetry stuff as well. So I still want to do adventures. I still want to do adventuring, but, you know, I'm not a gnarly hardcore survivalist, but it's like, how do I make it work for my life? And for me, I think that will be, you know, family, closer to home, a few bigger trips, kind of testing the water. I wish I could say I'm going to kayak down the Amazon with Willow, but, you know, we'll lead up to that. Maybe ask me in 3 years, like when I got a hand on motherhood.
Yeah, maybe you will, and I'm sure you will do, because, you know, from children are such an integral part of societies. I think I always think that it would be really fascinating to travel with small children into these communities, because I think your view of that and how you're viewed as well would open up so many doors.
I often think women make the best spies, because so often you go into communities and you're welcomed in as a woman, especially if you're a female solo traveller. They're like, what are you doing? We need to look after you. And I think the access that you have as a woman really does open up experiences. But I think add in a child to that and suddenly your world is so much more open. And we met a family on the road when we were cycling who took their kids out of school when they were 10 and 11. This family had been cycling for 5 years. And these children were the most erudite, well-spoken. They spoke 4 languages. And you just think, God, actually, there's different ways of educating people. There's different ways of learning about the world. Why be conventional?
I mean, what are your thoughts on solo female travel to some of these more remote places?
I think it's about being prepared, back to our point about doing risk assessments. And actually, personally, I prefer traveling with other people just because that's who I am as a person. But I have traveled on my own. And when I've done it, I've always trying to do it in a way that feels comfortable to me. So the first thing I ever did was I wanted to learn how to dive. So I went over to Malaysia and I did a course on my own. And I thought, well, at least that way I'm traveling on my own, but I'm going to be with a group. I'll have people there if I want. And that was sort of like the first entry step, if you know what I mean. And actually from that, I got a lot of confidence. And then I thought, I'll go to Mongolia on my own. And then and gradually going anywhere now, I'm like, well, I'll happily go on my own. Providing I take certain precautions. You know, I'm not sure I'd want to camp somewhere I felt uncomfortable. And I'd always say, listen to your instincts, because, you know, we're so intuitive as humans, and you get a sense of people, don't you? That kind of feeling. It's like, oh, I'm not sure about that. And when I'm on my own, if I'm not sure about someone, I won't be as polite or as smiley as I normally am. And I'll just take myself away and remove myself from those situations.
That's brilliant advice. Because I think, I mean, that intuition thing is a huge part. And I think, you know, we're taught, particularly as little girls, you know, to treat other people as we want to be treated and, you know, be always smiley and things, and almost to suppress that, you know, that instinct within us that kind of tells us, you know, we're programmed to read other people's body language and to kind of read, you know, their intentions towards us. And it kind of gets dumbed down within our society. So I think it's a really interesting point to that.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing that I love most about the jungle. You suddenly, your senses come alive in a way that you're like, oh, I didn't realize that. And so, you know, we had a jaguar come through the camp one evening, but there's something in our bodies that kind of sensed that there was something wrong. We were all like awake at like 2 a.m. going, this feels a bit funny. And what was really bizarre to me was the stress response when a jaguar came through the camp was not dissimilar to when I get a notification on my phone, like a WhatsApp message or an Instagram notification or something like that. And you're like, this is really messed up. Like, we shouldn't have, admittedly, it was a way more advanced and a stronger feeling when the jaguar came through the camp, but we're kind of simulating these environments and in a very artificial way that we're losing touch with those senses, I think.
Yeah, and what is that feeling?
Oh, it's that kind of panic. It's like that fight or flight thing that kicks in. You're like, oh God, I might be eaten. And you're not going to be eaten by your emails, but it's
fleshy. Well,
you never know how many you're going to get. You might drown in them, maybe. But yeah, it's the strangest thing, because actually we've got these things in our pockets. These phones are constantly going off. And that's the beauty of just disconnecting when you go outside. It's like, actually, sod it. I don't have any signal. So coming home, I'm definitely trying to be more in control of how I use tech and not let it use me.
And how do you do that?
8 p.m. don't turn on your phone. Like, it's not good for you. I say that, like, practice what you preach. I sometimes check Instagram at 10 o'clock. I'm like, no.
It sucks you in, doesn't it?
It really so addictive. Does. Yeah. It really does. But also knowing that.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because you only ever see, you know, the highlights of somebody's life as well, don't you, on social media. And it's like, it's all very, very curated, isn't it? So although you can get a sense for somebody, you don't know what's going on beneath the surface.
Yeah, and it's really dangerous as well. So I think one of my embarrassing moments, I think, on this entire kayaking journey, I realized looking at my social media feed that I was taking selfie after selfie after selfie. And I looked back on my feed after kind of halfway through this trip, and I was like, God, like, I'm a journalist. I'm not telling the story of the people that I'm with well. You know, the YY barely featured in my social media account. And I thought, this is so wrong. You know, I'm not doing justice to the people that I'm with, and our guides, like people who, without who we wouldn't be able to do this trip. And after that, I kind of had this moment of like, actually, you know what? I'm posting selfies because I get more likes. That's just wrong. Like, let's start posting what I'm interested in, i.e. poetry, other people, landscapes. So now I don't get as much engagement necessarily. I don't get as many likes. But do you know what? I look back at my social media feed and I'm like, I feel more comfortable with what I'm portraying rather than just my own face. So that was a real interesting kind of, I don't know, revelation I had on the trip about social media.
That's fascinating, isn't it? It's, the whole social media world, it's like makes us very self-aware and things, and push ourselves out and images of ourselves that we're not actually necessarily, isn't really true to ourselves and our core values. It's really interesting, like, why that is.
It's bizarre. But and also, I think we live in a world of brands, and we live in a world of, like, especially on adventures, a lot of it is sponsorship. So if you don't put yourself with your sponsor's gear or whatever on your Instagram, you're not going to necessarily be funded for the trip. So there's a definite balance, and it works both ways. But I think it's kind of making sure you're comfortable with that balance. And I always say now, post for the soul, not the self.
And is there a lot of pressure from the brands to get certain content?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's, but again, you take this on. If you're doing a sponsored trip, you know what you're getting into, because you're kind of going to them and saying, look, I'll share this on social media. And it's definitely like a win-win for both camps. But it's kind of, again, it's sort of like finding that balance between what's authentically me and kind of commercials of it as well.
Yeah, because I definitely think it's, you know, there's a fallacy that, you know, to be an adventurer, you get given all this free kit and you get lots of money thrown at you. And it's just not true, is it?
Oh, no. I wish. Like, where are those money pots? But again, that's the beauty of adventure. You don't have to have a shed ton of money to get started. It's like our bike trip. That's the cheapest form of travel, really. We took a tent. We ate tinned food. I mean, admittedly, it was a lot of pasta and tomato sauce that we had for a good couple of months. But really low cost, because you're camping, you're cycling, you just need some money for visas. And again, you know, we'd saved up for this trip. So if you plan, you can do things in a very low cost way.
Pip, there's this beautiful material hanging on your wall there. It's like, it's really pretty. There's a lot of very vibrant colours on that. What is that?
So that was actually a skirt. So
really?
I went to Peru to film a documentary on deforestation and found this skirt in one of the markets. And I absolutely loved it. And I thought, you know what, it's kind of black and colourful and it's got these very geometric patterns all over it. I'll wear it in London. Came back and I'm like, I'm not going to wear that in London. It just didn't kind of have the right vibe, I don't think. But I loved it and I thought, I'll get it framed and put it on my wall. And it's one of those things that makes me really happy when I look at it.
It's mesmerising, isn't it? It's like a brain with all like the little bits sparking off in it.
Well, it was designed by the Shipibo people, and apparently it's meant to represent ayahuasca, so the plant medicine which people often use in the jungle. And it's sort of representing the kind of trip that you have on that plant, in a sense. But I love it. It's just super colourful and reminds me of my time talking to communities when we were in Peru and Brazil, looking at deforestation and the issues around that.
Yeah, because journalism is at the heart of everything that you do. It's this thread that runs through everything and kind of, I suppose, ties all your life together. Why is that so important to you?
Do you know what? I think, for me, I've just always loved learning. And one of my favourite things to say is everyone can teach you something. And through journalism, through talking to people, you just grow, I think. And again, it comes back to being very nosy. And like the skirt, for example, you know, before I went out to Brazil and Peru, I'd read about deforestation. I'd sort of cognitively knew about it. But when you're staring at someone who's lost their father because he was murdered by an illegal logger, those kind of heartbreaking or heartwarming stories often are the ones that really stick with you and sort of make you appreciate life, because I don't think you can tell a story without a certain level of emotion. And I used to work in hard news. I used to report like business news and sit there in Hong Kong reading the news. And ultimately, I sort of felt it lacked a bit of heart. And that's when I did those adventures, when I started cycling, they were the ones that started to put a little bit more emotion into the story. And that's when I started to feel like, actually, this is how I want to tell stories, because it's what connects us, right? It's, you can be very surface, you can be very practical. And but I think it's when someone, you see in their eyes pain or you see happiness or whatever it is, that's really what's going to change things. So yeah, I think that's why I absolutely love storytelling. It's just that the power of that.
So for somebody who might be wanting to get into journalism and telling these stories and documenting their adventures, what are the steps that you would take for somebody starting out?
Well, I went off to university. I went back to do a master's in journalism, but you definitely don't need to do that. It's literally a case of get out into your community and start asking people questions. And I think, in many ways, I could have saved myself a lot of time by not going to uni and just kind of getting out into my community. But ask people what the problems are, like what's bothering you. For example, where I live in Wittering, it's a beach. It's making sure it's clean, or, you know, we're often out litter picking and stuff like that. And you're suddenly, OK, so where is that litter coming from? What's happening? And work backwards from a story. Or so I'd say find the problems and try and figure out like what's causing them. Follow what you're interested in, because guaranteed if you're interested in a certain niche, someone else will be. But I think if you've got like an interest and are willing to dive into a story a little bit, there's always like an angle somewhere. And then, I don't know, just be inquisitive, because you know, the world is brilliant. There's a lot of cool stuff out there, a lot of problems. And actually, you can solve both in a sense through journalism. But yeah, just try it. Like, get out, talk to people. Social media is really powerful. Reach out to people you respect who are writing the stories or producing stories that you're interested in. Shadow them, reach out to them, ask for a coffee. Lots you can do online.
Pip, thank you so much for that.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Megan. I loved it.
So I've just come away from chatting to Pip, and it's just been such a fascinating interview, from her stories of journalism through to adventure and how she goes about finding these stories and the passion behind these stories as well. It's just been so incredibly enlightening. Of Adventure was a TBI production brought to you by Wilbur Smith, the 21st century master of adventure storytelling. Adventure enables self-discovery through direct experience or from the perspective of someone else. Find out more at wilbursmithbooks.com.